On Tech News Today, Google's new wireless service finally happened. But Comcast's merger with Time Warner might not happen. And Eric Schmidt said everyone on the planet would be connected to the internet by the end of the decade. And there's no way that's going to happen. And we'll tell you why. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, April 22nd, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Little Bits, the easy way to build electronics with modular building blocks. Go to littlebits.com/TNT and you'll get $20 off your first kit, plus free shipping in the U.S. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin. Welcome to the show. Today is Earth Day, ladies and gentlemen. My wife called me as I was walking in the door and said, make sure you mention Earth Day. And unless you hate the environment, this is a day that is important to all of us. Now, Google is actually doing something interesting for Earth Day. They are matching donations to the Maasai Wilderness Conservation Trust. And every $10 donation gets you an entry to win a 20-minute Google Hangout with actor Edward Norton for some reason. I guess Edward Norton is very much into the Maasai Wilderness Conservation Trust. So that means if you donate $100, that's 10 entries. So the more that you donate, the more likely you are to speak with the star of American History X, etc. So I've been to the Maasai Mara in Kenya, and let me tell you, the Maasai Wilderness is something worth conserving. So I highly recommend that anybody else who loves that ecosystem or likes the planet Earth to donate and take Google up on their offer to match funds. Well, let's jump right into the news. Google is expected to launch a U.S. wireless phone service any minute now. The service is expected to pressure carriers with lower and simpler pricing, free international roaming, and other benefits. Ron Amadeo is a reviews editor for Ars Technica and joins us now to talk about this. Welcome to you, Ron.
Hi, Mike. Great to be here.
I'm glad you're here. Now, how will Google's wireless service be different from other wireless services that are currently available?
So they're going to be a mobile network reseller, kind of like the same as Straight Talk and Ting and stuff like that. But they're going to license data from two different companies, Sprint and T-Mobile. And they're going to combine them along with Wi-Fi and seamlessly switch from one to the other, depending on what's giving you the best signal right now, which should be pretty unique.
Does anybody do anything like that at this point? I mean, it sounds like a great idea, obviously. And if Google can do it, then the technical capability exists. But is anybody else doing anything like this?
No, not that I know of. T-Mobile will do Wi-Fi calling, but like Google will own, because they own hardware, software, and they'll control the network, they'll be able to make this seamless switching thing happen.
Now, this is supposed to put pressure on the regular carriers. So why are two regular carriers helping Google do it and providing the network access? Aren't they kind of working against themselves in a way, or competing against, helping Google compete against them?
Yeah, I was thinking that too, but they managed to convince them to do it. Supposedly, there's some limitations on how many users they can sign up. That was in an earlier report, so we'll see. We don't necessarily have all the details right now. You know, it might launch today. Hopefully, we'll find everything out.
And that is an important point to mention, which is that this is nothing that has been announced by Google. They haven't said anything publicly. Well, they haven't said much publicly about it. I guess Sundar Pichai confirmed that something like this was coming. This was first reported by The Information in January, and there have been little reports on multiple publications trickling out. So all of this, I guess, technically is in the realm of rumor, but so we don't know anything for sure, so that's a great point. But based on those rumors and those reports, how will the data pricing work? Because I think this is one of the more interesting aspects of this service, at least from what we've heard so far.
Yeah, get this, you will only pay for the data that you use. So like if you're at home, you can be on Wi-Fi, you're not using any data, you know, you really won't get billed. It's only when you're, you know, out actually using data. Like everybody else forces you to buy a like 3 gigabyte bucket every month and you have to pay it. But if you're a light user, you could potentially have a very cheap bill.
Now, of course, Google has Google Fiber, which brought them into the internet access business. They started in one community and then they've been rolling it out and they're planning on multiple communities. I imagine this might be the same thing. Do we have a sense or some likely plans about how they'll roll this out in terms of which phones it'll come out on, which areas, or how limited or broad it will be?
Yeah, it's going to be on the Nexus 6 only to start with, supposedly. This isn't like a world domination move that Google does sometimes. This is going to be like exactly like Google Fiber, where it's like a low usage thing, but hopefully competition kicks in and, you know, other carriers start to lower prices or offer better service or something like that.
All right. Well, it sounds really interesting. And of course, a 2013 study by Validus says that smartphone users waste an average of $28 each month on unused data. Hopefully something like this will, for those who use it, and possibly if Google is successful in pressuring other companies, if in fact that is their goal, this situation will improve itself and people won't be wasting so much money on unused data. Ron Amadeo is at ArsTechnica.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Ron Amadeo. Thank you for joining us today, Ron.
Thank you.
Let us know what you think about Google's plans, or at least what we know about Google's plans so far, by sending email to tnt@twit.tv. Well, in just a sec, we got some more news. But first, let's talk about Little Bits. Come on, let's face it. We're all a bunch of kids. That's why we love technology, even though we are adults. And Little Bits is going to let you play with technology, but in a real way. Little Bits is a modular building block system that enables you to basically build things, lots of different things. There are over 60 modules that can be used in virtually limitless creative combinations. They snap together with magnets. So it's like you can pull them apart and put them back together and try different things and experiment. Or you can go and try to design something and build it essentially from scratch. They have the base and deluxe kits, which are great for kids and beginners. There's even an Arduino coding kit. So if you're interested in the software aspect of building things, you can use this to actually build hardware essentially and then code for it using Arduino. Really great stuff. The deluxe kit includes 18 modules that snap together with literally billions of circuits. You don't have to do any wiring. There's no circuits. This isn't the old-fashioned kind of Heath kit type of thing. You just snap it together. It's just a lot of fun and very easy to do, and you may surprise yourself by how much you enjoy it. If you're a musician, they have something called the Synth Kit, which is a modular analog synthesizer. Everybody loves using Little Bits. It's basically, come on, let's be honest. These are toys. This is a lot of fun. And so you don't really have to grow up. You can play with Little Bits all you like and also learn a lot about technology and circuitry and gadgets and so on. Little Bits is offering new customers $20 off their first kit plus free shipping in the U.S. Just go to littlebits.com/TNT. That's littlebits.com/TNT. And if you post something and, if you make something, post a picture of it on Instagram. We'd love to see it. Well, Comcast's proposed $45.2 billion acquisition of Time Warner Cable might be in trouble, according to some reports. Both companies are meeting today with the U.S. Department of Justice to discuss the deal. Liz Hoffman is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and joins us to talk about this deal. Welcome to you, Liz.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Now, why would the Justice Department be reluctant to approve this merger?
Well, look, they're the two biggest cable companies in the country, number one and number two. And the concern, to the extent that it bears out, is that when you combine them, they just have a ton of power over pricing, over where good content lands, over broadband access, all of which is, you know, bad news for other cable companies and certainly for services like Netflix or Hulu, which are all competing for the best content.
Now, you wrote a really interesting piece about how much the banks are going to lose if this thing falls through. Can you talk a little bit about why that is the case and what exactly they'll lose?
Sure. I mean, look, the question is whether it's good for the public. It's certainly very good for Wall Street. There are about a dozen banks that stand to get somewhere between $300 and $400 million in fees off of this. Fees are generally based on the size of the deal, so it's not terribly surprising that these numbers are large. But what's interesting here is that it's not just the Comcast Time Warner merger. There were a whole bunch of other transactions that kind of got spawned up in this cable deal making ecosystem. that all depend on this deal going through. So Charter has a couple of transactions that are contingent on this, the Bright House deal for one. So there are a lot of people on Wall Street that have a lot vested here.
Now, another story on the Wall Street Journal site said that Comcast's interaction with Hulu may affect the DOJ's thinking about the Time Warner deal. I don't know. You didn't write that piece, but can you talk a little bit about that that story?
I didn't. Sure, I know just enough to be dangerous here. But when Comcast basically agreed to be a silent partner in the management of Hulu, and there were some deal talks around that a little while back, and the Justice Department is looking into whether they really sort of abided by that promise, and whether they can be, the idea is really whether they can be trusted to comply with concessions and other handcuffs that get put on them going forward, possibly as part of a settlement for the Time Warner cable deal.
Now, if this deal isn't approved, will this affect other big deals currently under consideration, do you think?
Sure. So there are two big transactions that are very explicitly contingent on this one getting done. One is Charter's $10 billion purchase of Bright House, a privately held smaller cable company. That deal won't happen if this one doesn't. The reasoning there from people we've spoken to is that, if you'll remember, Charter kicked this whole thing off 2 years ago trying to go after Time Warner Cable and got rebuffed and eventually lost out to Comcast. So if you know, Time Warner Cable becomes free again, they'd like to be able to go after it. So that's a deal that wouldn't happen. And there's a side deal between Comcast and Charter where Comcast would sell about 3.9 million subscribers to Charter for about $20 billion in cash and some other assets. So that is also contingent. So you're looking at $30 billion worth of deals that are also going to be sort of the next dominoes to fall if this one doesn't go through.
Okay, putting you on the spot here, is this deal going to be approved or denied?
I really don't know. Look, anytime you're going, you have a two to you know, a one and two merger. There are basically four big cable players out there. This would be three, and these are two very big companies. What they've said is, look, they don't compete in the same market. So if you have Time Warner Cable, it's not like you could go to Comcast and now you won't be able to. That, you know, they're geographically dispersed. So that's one side. You know, how they deal with customers, people who pay for their cable. The other is sort of the agreements that they strike with content providers. You know, with the studios and the networks and all that stuff, because they obviously compete to get the best programming. And the question is, would they be able to either charge more or say, you know, we won't air your show unless no one else can have it? And that really does impact content providers' bottom line. And you know, if you play the tape through to the end, impacts what you and I would be able to see on Hulu or Amazon Prime or something like that.
Interesting. It's a big deal. There's a lot at stake. A lot of money to be lost and so on. Liz Hoffman is at WSJ.com. And you can follow her on Twitter at Liz R. Hoffman. Thank you for joining us today, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
Let us know what you think about the Time Warner merger with Comcast. Send email to tnt@twit.tv and let us know if you approve it or if you'd like the Department of Justice to deny it. And please tell us why. Now, Google has emerged to become one of the biggest spenders on lobbying of the federal government, according to a new report by MapLight. Larry Dignan is the editor-in-chief of ZDNet and Smart Planet. I mentioned Smart Planet because today's Earth Day. And welcome to you, Larry.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. Now, how much money did Google spend on lobbying for the first quarter this year?
They spent almost $5.5 million in the first quarter, which is a pretty big sum for them. And it actually put them in the top 10 for, from what I can tell, one of the first times. They're up there with the Chamber of Commerce, Realtors, the American Medical Association, and a bunch of lobbying groups that are, you know, pretty much standbys in, among Congress.
So does Google spend more than other tech companies? I seem to recall that they were kind of a tightwad when it came to spending on lobbying.
Yeah, well, that made me kind of look at MapLight's database a little closer. And they compile figures dating back to 2008. And what's interesting here is that Google spent a little more than $74 million since 2008 to date. And, you know, when you compare that to AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, you know, which all three obviously have a big net neutrality thing, they're smaller. You know, those big carriers spent, AT&T spent $117 million. Verizon and Comcast both spent about $112 million. And then Google's the next one down at 70, almost 75. So it's interesting because you don't really think of Google as a big lobbying effort, but right. they are involved a lot when it comes to cash. Compared to Microsoft spent $58.66 million in that same time frame, and IBM spent almost $38 million or so. So when you see that, you know, Google's become a bit of a lobbying powerhouse.
And I guess the big question is the money helping Google? I mean, they're pretty much under attack. And, you know, actually, the truth is that they were recently under investigation for, you know, the same thing that they're currently under investigation in Europe for, which is gaming their shopping results. And they sort of got off with less than a slap on the wrist. So do you think that this lobbying money is actually paying off for Google?
Well, if you look at what they're actually lobbying for, you know, their list of things in the first quarter was things like patent litigation, skilled immigration, net neutrality, and broadband deployments. But having Google in front of your face, in front of legislators' face a lot, has got to have some impact. Obviously, they're not lobbying enough in the EU because the EU's basically, they're on their butts all the time. And you know, Google's an interesting case because they've got tremendous market power, but they probably don't meet that definition of like a traditional monopoly, right? Because they can always say, well, you can always click away and go someplace else. So it's an interesting game, but I gotta think there's some, you know, there's obviously some side benefit to being in front of Washington all the time.
There's got to be. And I wonder about the correlation between benefit and how much is spent, simply because if you look at the money that anybody who lobbies the federal government spends, it sounds like a lot of money until you look at the amount of money that Silicon Valley throws around on nothing. And so, right. you know, you were talking about millions, less than $100 million in a quarter. You know, Google spends that on catering or something. I mean, they, you know, in a region or an industry where Facebook spent $22 billion to buy a messaging app and that sort of thing. I mean, it's really a tiny amount of money. And you can imagine that if there was a one-to-one correlation between influence and money, you know, Google might spend $1 billion a year or something like that and just dictate policy. But I don't think that's the case. I think that you want to spend a certain amount. You want to, like you say, be in people's faces, have your voice heard. But at some point, it seems to me, based on the actual spending, that there is a limit to how much influence you can actually buy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a limit. I think a lot of it is, I mean, if you actually look at the returns on lobbying, it's probably, you know, I mean, like in enterprise tech, we call it soft returns, right? I don't think it's something you can draw a straight line to and say, yeah, well, we got this because we spent this. I think it's more of a case of, you know, Google gets to argue its case. They get to talk about their pet projects, and they get to put a face with a name, right? So, and I think that helps over time, and that's, you know, that's what you see with the tech companies that are on that list, right? I mean, Amazon spent, I think, $18 million since like 2008 on lobbying, but if you look at them in recent quarters, there's been a lot of lobbying about drones, right? So you can kind of see. Yeah, you got to kind of play the game a little bit, for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you'd be hard pressed to say, you know, we spent this much on lobbying, so therefore we didn't get investigated, right? And as we've seen from, you know, like that EU case against Google, I mean, everything will change by the time that thing gets settled.
Yeah, right, in 10 years, EU moves awfully slow. And you had mentioned Amazon and their lobbying, and you know, even that relatively small amount is a lot more than they used to spend. But of course, right. Jeff Bezos also has the Washington Post as an instrument for influencing Congress and so on. So yeah, I remember distinctly years ago, the big technology companies were kind of aloof about lobbying, basically said that we don't need to play those games because we, you know, and then I think what started it was Microsoft getting just hammered by the Department of Justice for their antitrust bundling, you know, issue, the bundling of Internet Explorer with Windows. And then I think Microsoft started spending, they started having all these different groups that sort of propagandize things. They have several anti-Google groups, which may or may not have had an influence in Europe. So it's really a fascinating thing to see the technology industry become essentially a regular industry.
I think that's the big takeaway, right? That they have to play the game. where I think before they thought they were above it.
Yeah. And of course, Congress will get their perks and their money and their campaign contributions and all the rest one way or the other. It's kind of a kind of a protection racket. Ultimately, if you really look at it, which it's probably better not to look at it. Larry Dignan.
Yeah, exactly.
Larry Dignan is at ZDNet.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at LDignan. Thanks for joining us today, Larry.
Thanks a lot.
Let us know what you think about Silicon Valley's lobbying of the federal government. Send email to TNT at twit.tv. Let us know what's on your mind. Well, Amazon launched a new travel service yesterday called Amazon Destinations. CNET tech reporter Ben Fox Rubin joins us to talk about it. Welcome to you, Ben.
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
It's going great. Thanks. Now, what can Amazon bring to the online travel business that TripAdvisor, Expedia, Kayak, Airbnb, and Hipmunk cannot?
That is hard to know at this point. And it's hard to say whether Amazon knows exactly how it's going to differentiate in this space quite yet. They came out with Amazon Destinations yesterday with very little fanfare. There wasn't even an official press release or anything like that. And service just starts in the Seattle, Los Angeles, and New York City areas. So it is markedly smaller than a lot of those other sites that you had mentioned. But as a good reference is Amazon Prime Now, which Amazon started as a one-hour delivery service in December. They started that pretty small in Manhattan and I think in Brooklyn or pretty soon after in Brooklyn. And they've been expanding that over and over and over again. So it's possible that they're going to kind of take on the same strategy where they start small and then keep building from there.
Are there any synergies that Amazon has? I mean, for example, where does this fit into their whole business model? Is it just a travel business out there on its own in isolation, or is this integrated somehow with some of their other offerings?
It's integrated into Amazon Local, which is kind of their Groupon play where you can get different daily discounts, entertainment, baseball tickets, different things like that. So you can kind of perceive how travel or leisure or different destination getaways could fit reasonably well into those types of things. If you're looking for a restaurant, maybe you want to do kind of a quick getaway. And that's kind of an important thing to mention too about this is that it's kind of like for short weekend trips around your area. It's not really meant to take you to Tahiti or anything like that. But as you said, does it really fit into their broader business of, you know, selling books and washing machines and all sorts of other things? I mean, Amazon Local in general to me seems like more of a side project to that. But if they can build the number of eyeballs to Amazon Local like they have on their regular site, then sure, we'll sell you more stuff. So that's kind of the play that I see.
I think it's one thing for companies like Google to be in all kinds of random businesses and for companies like Facebook to have, you know, flying drones and all the rest. But Amazon is a company that basically operates near zero margin. They have very low margins. They try to not make very much profit so they can plow all of their revenue back into the business and so that they can grow, so they can clobber competitors and so on. Do you think that they're overextending themselves with all these new services they've been announcing recently?
So that's been the question for years about Amazon, right? And they don't seem to be letting up much at all. When Jeff Bezos was in New York a couple months ago for a Business Insider conference, he kind of directly addressed this idea of at least, you know, we're gonna keep trying to hit home runs. We're not going to succeed every single time, but we're going to keep trying to take risks. And that kind of, to me, seemed like a reference that they're not going to really kind of give up on various moonshots and different services and different projects. I think during that talk, he mentioned how AWS, their public cloud business, was kind of just started out of nowhere. And Amazon sold books before, so why would they get into the public cloud? Well, that's become a really important and really big business for them. So from my interpretation, it seems that Bezos wants to keep finding those types of home runs. Not all of these are going to end up making it, but they're going to keep trying. Particularly in the travel and leisure segment, that's a really competitive area. But if they find that they're getting even a little bit of traction on it, then they have reason to keep going.
And they also, I have to say, have a bit of Google envy. They tend to get into the businesses that Google gets into. I don't know if that's by coincidence or because they're just really gunning for Google. A lot of times companies in the tech industry become obsessed with other companies, and they spend a lot of effort trying to emulate and beat them in on every front. But we'll see how they do with this destinations service. Ben Fox Rubin is at CNET.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Ben Fox Rubin. Thanks for joining us today, Ben.
Thanks.
Writing for the Wall Street Journal, Evelyn Roosley says that Google and Facebook's race to connect the next billion people that we've talked about a lot on this show is a lot harder than it sounds. In fact, she says internet user growth is actually slowing down. Evelyn joins us now. Welcome to you, Evelyn.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Now, Google Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt once said that I think it was 2 years ago, said that everyone in the world would be connected by the end of the decade. Are we anywhere near being on track to make that happen?
Yeah, it seems very unlikely, despite all the talk of drones and balloons and high-tech satellites, which we know both Facebook and Google are working on. I traveled to Indonesia with a very kind of open mind on, you know, looking into this issue of connectivity in emerging markets. And it was surprising to find that it wasn't just about tech and it wasn't just about affordability that kept people offline, but it's these very soft issues, this idea of many people don't even know why they would want a smartphone or why they'd want to be on the internet that these tech giants are going to have to battle. And so because of this pain point, I imagine it'll be very hard to meet that goal of getting everyone online by the end of the decade.
Now, you wrote that, speaking of Indonesia, that, you know, Indonesia is a huge country. 250 million people live in Indonesia, and only 16% of that population is connected to the internet. I think they're a good, sort of mental exercise for what could happen. What would happen if Indonesia's sort of population became as roughly connected as a lot of other companies, north of 50%. How would this change their economy?
It's a very interesting question. I think we're sort of seeing it play out in real time, at least, you know, in the early innings. When I was in Jakarta, you know, they clearly had a very nascent e-commerce business, for instance, but it is starting to pick up. You do see people become more comfortable with using their phones, of becoming active members of the digital economy. I think in places like Indonesia currently, there's a lot of social barriers, a lot of this uncomfortableness with the internet. And for example, you know, Indonesia has had issues with scams, for instance, in the past, and there's a lot of mistrust or lack of trust when it comes to using online payments and, you know, considering also when you compound the lack of a banking system in Indonesia. So these countries, I think, represent enormous opportunity for what could happen. I mean, you see in some of these capitals, like in Jakarta, that a lot of people do really enjoy the social aspects. Once they do get on their smartphones, they're incredibly active, which is why Indonesia is so active on Twitter and Facebook consistently, of the small population that is using the internet regularly. But there's still a long way to go. So I think what will happen to Indonesia when that day passes, when, you know, up to 50% or more people are online, is really fascinating. But it does feel like it's a long way off.
Now, I'm sorry to interrupt this interview, but we have breaking news, which is that Google's Project Fi, which is the wireless service that we talked about at the top of the show, has now launched. And if you want to check that out, go to Fi, that's fi.google.com, and you can check that out. So again, Google's wireless service now exists. There's a video and lots of details on that website. Again, that's fi.google.com. Now, Evelyn, companies like Google and Facebook have hatched all kinds of crazy schemes. You mentioned some of them, but they involve balloons and drones and satellites and all those kinds of things to reach people in remote areas. These are pretty splashy efforts. Are these the kind of things that are going to make it happen, or are these just or is it other things? I guess the real question is, what is it that's preventing people from getting online? Is it financial? Is it educational? Is it physical, something that could be overcome by balloons? Is it political? What really is keeping the majority of the Earth's population offline?
Yeah, it's more of these softer social issues. So while drones and balloons are certainly the sexiest thing to talk about when it comes to connectivity, because who doesn't like to fantasize about what crazy gizmos we can send into the sky to beam down the internet, what's really fascinating is that many people who could theoretically be online tomorrow because they are near a 3G network or a cell phone is only $50, a smartphone is only $50 nearby, are still not choosing to be online. So the question is, how do you get people who don't necessarily see the value of the internet to understand why it could be critical to their lives? And I talked to Mark Zuckerberg about this issue, and he said, you know, when he first started looking at internet.org, he really thought it was going to be a matter of getting really cool tech online and reducing just the cost, you know, battling the idea that, you know, maybe people can't afford these data plans or these phones. And he said what was really shocking was that at the end of the day, there was most people just didn't understand why they should be using the internet. And I think we take it for granted in the West because, you know, we grew up in this stuff and it's so ubiquitous. And it's like, of course you'd want to be on Facebook. Of course you'd want to be on Twitter and using the bajillion apps that are available on the iPhone. But when you step outside of the West and you go into some of these emerging economies, you know, you kind of have to explain and kind of handhold people to understand, you know, how this could improve their lives, particularly when they're not making that much money and this is going to be somewhat of a sacrifice economically. So the hardest problem is not tech, it's not necessarily poverty-based values, but it is kind of showing people why, how they can use the internet to improve their lives.
Sounds like balloons aren't going to do it. Evelyn, you're on the phone. You're calling in by telephone. And we put up a picture on the screen. And so what we did was we grabbed your Twitter profile picture. And in that picture, there's a small creature in the corner of the picture.
Yeah.
What the heck is that, that guy photobombing your Twitter profile pic?
So that's a little sloth. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with the internet personality at Darth.
Yes.
No one knows exactly who or she is, but I actually put that photo up when I was reporting in Indonesia, and Darth added a little sloth baby in the background, and that's been my picture ever since. So I know, it looks a little weird.
Well, I want to thank you and Sloth Baby for coming on Tech News today. Evelyn Rusley is at evelynrusley.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at EveLynrusL, and you can check out Baby Sloth there as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Okay, take care now.
All right, bye-bye. Well, Microsoft announced a new Windows 10 security feature yesterday called Device Guard. It enables enterprises to lock down Windows desktops so they can't run anything except trusted apps approved by the company or signed by specific software companies or maybe coming from the Microsoft Store. You get to configure it to lock it down and however you choose if you are in fact an enterprise administrator. The feature had been discussed in the past by Microsoft, but now it has a name. Well, in mergers and acquisitions news, Path is trying to sell its Path Classic app to Daum Kakao, the company that makes South Korea's KakaoTalk app. Blame Indonesia. Speaking of Indonesia, boy, Indonesia's making a big appearance on the show today. Turns out that Path Classic never really took off in the United States, but it's huge in Indonesia. In fact, the majority of Path's 30 million active users are in that country. The Indonesian market is interesting to Daum Kakao, but not Path, which plans instead to focus on its spin-off messaging app, PathTalk, as well as its new selfie GIF app called Kong, which was recently announced. Well, more news in just a sec, but first let's talk about Gazelle. You know I love Gazelle. I love them in part, let's be honest, because I'm lazy and I like gadgets. And of course, in order for me to fund my next gadget, I got to raise some funds. And there's no easier way to do that than with the old gadget. You just go to gazelle.com. That's Gazelle's website. Choose the device that you own that you'd like to sell and indicate its condition. They'll give you a price. If you like that price, and I think you almost certainly will, they'll send you a box. You just throw it in the box and then mail it back. You get paid. It's super, super easy. And the sooner you do it, the more you will get paid. And the sooner your old device will get into the hands of someone new. And of course, if you want to buy a pre-owned device from Gazelle, that is super easy now. They have certified like new devices, just like brand new devices, except they're less expensive. So if you have a certain budget, you can get a better phone. You can get a better tablet than you would have been able to get with that same money by buying it from Gazelle. And if you want to save a lot of money, they have certified good devices. And of course, all devices have been put through a 30-point inspection to make sure that they work great. And they're all backed by a 30-day risk-free return policy. That's right. If you're not sure that you want to buy a device from Gazelle, buy one anyway. You risk nothing. If for whatever reason you want to return it, just return it within 30 days and you'll get your money back. Really no risk. There's no reason not to buy your next phone from Gazelle. Find out what your iPhone's worth. Take a minute and go to gazelle.com to find out. And we thank Gazelle for their support of Tech News Today. Yahoo announced first quarter earnings yesterday, reporting revenue of $1.04 billion for the quarter, which sounds good, but it's actually less than expectations. The good news is that mobile revenue is up, and everybody assumes that mobile revenue is the future, so they are doing well in that key area. So good for Yahoo, even though they missed expectations. Of course, Wall Street lowered the price of their stock after that, but not by too much. So they're doing okay. They're not dying, but they're not super knocking it out of the park either. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Nicholas B., who posted a video on Google Plus, and he says he listens to TNT through, get this, folks, his collection of vintage radios, which are enabled with podcast support using a Raspberry Pi and a hand-built AM transmitter. That's right. He has a Raspberry Pi device that he's hooked up to transmit AM radio, and then these old radios pick up the signal, and then that's how we listen to Tech News Today. This video, go ahead and play the video, Jason, shows a Grundig Satellite 1000. He also wants to point out that he listens to AM radio broadcasts in Australia every day, but check this out.
That Spiro, which is the company that helped Disney create the road. Disney World.
Unbelievable. That is really cool. I really appreciate that. Now, meanwhile, another TNT fan named Robert Hill posted this gem on Twitter. Let's take a look at this. I don't know if this is actually real. I'm guessing it isn't, but it's just a reminder to donate to the Maasai Relief Fund before this lion eats me on the Maasai Mara. Wow, that is cool. Send your real or your fake pictures to me to TNT at twit.tv, or you can post them on Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook. Make sure you use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT if you post them on social networks so we can find it. And you can, of course, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on YouTube. Just go to youtube.com/technewstoday and click on the subscribe button. Choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. And if you'd like to help us grow our audience, here's how you can do it. Post a link to twit.tv/TNT on the social media site of your choice. Tag three of your friends along with your recommendation to subscribe, and we'll grow even faster. And we thank you for doing that. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv or on the app or browser plugin of your choice. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can follow me personally on Google Plus. Just go to googleplus.com/plusMikeElgin. And let us know what you think. Send an email to TNT at twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW. Don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. The show is produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you tomorrow.